OMG, what are they doing keeping a three-headed dog locked up in the castle?
Yeah, honestly, if any dog needs exercise, that one does.
You don't use your eyes, either of you. Didn't you see what it was standing on?
The floor? I wasn't looking at its feet. I was too busy with its heads.
It was standing on a trap door. That dog is obviously guarding something.
Guarding something? What could it be?
This podcast is the property of
The Half-Blood Princesses.
I'm Demi.
I'm Jess.
The story will begin in a flourish. Hey everyone, welcome to episode 13 of The Half-Blood Princesses. We are thrilled to be back again.
Yes, we are. And if you haven't followed us already, what are you doing? We have Facebook and YouTube, The Half-Blood Princesses, a Harry Potter podcast, and Twitter and Instagram at HB Princesses Pod. If you like our podcast, leave us a voicemail at 412-228-5435, and it'll be featured in a future episode. So, Demi, what is the topic of magical episode 13?
Our topic is the Sorcerer's Stone. And to talk all about the Sorcerer's Stone with us, we have a very special guest, Joe from Tales from Godric's Hollow.
Hey everybody, how's it going?
So Joe is going to share his Wizarding World profile.
All right, well, I am a proud Hufflepuff. My wand is 10 and 3/4 lengths of maple wood with a unicorn hair core. My Patronus is a red squirrel, which, to be honest, I'm not sure how they differentiate the colors since they're all like a wispy, silvery bluish. But at least it's special in that way. I was a little disappointed it was a squirrel. But what are you going to do? My favorite book is Half-Blood Prince. My favorite character is Neville Longbottom because I love the underdogs. My favorite Hogwarts class is Defense Against the Dark Arts. But a close second, Transfiguration.
That's awesome. Defense Against the Dark Arts is my favorite class too, but Lupin is obviously the best teacher.
I have so much respect for you because I'm a Hufflepuff too, and your favorite character is Neville, and you're literally the only other person I know who says Neville's his favorite character.
Really?
Yep.
That's interesting. Neville was always my favorite. As soon as I got introduced to the series a little weird, so I was a movie guy first before I even read any of the books. And since going through the entire series, Neville has always been my favorite.
Same, same.
And also, it's kind of cool that your favorite book is The Half-Blood Prince because we're the Half-Blood Princesses, so it works really well.
And you're our honorary half-blood prince for this episode.
Why, thank you.
So, how odd is it, you guys, that this is episode 13 and in Gringotts, the Sorcerer's Stone was kept in Vault 713?
Full disclosure, we did not plan this.
It always ends up working out that way, though. It's just like JK to tease us in the beginning with a little bit of something and then reveal it much later on. And here we are, episode 13 with the Sorcerer's Stone.
Totally. So now let's get into our quote about the Sorcerer's Stone.
It's time for Quick Quotes Corner. Today's quote comes from chapter 15 of Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone called The Forbidden Forest. This is part of Harry's conversation with Ferenz in the forest. Harry Potter, do you know what unicorn blood is used for? No, said Harry, startled by the odd question. We've only used the horn and tail hair in potions. That is because it is a monstrous thing. To slay a unicorn, said Ferenz, only one who has nothing to lose and everything to gain would commit such a crime. The blood of a unicorn will keep you alive, even if you are an inch from death, but at a terrible price. You have slain something pure and defenseless to save yourself, and you will have but a half-life. A cursed life, from the moment the blood touches your lips. Harry stared at the back of Ferenz's head, which was dappled silver in the moonlight. But who'd be that desperate? He wondered aloud. If you're going to be cursed forever, death's better, isn't it? It is, Ferenz agreed, unless all you need is to stay alive long enough to drink something else, something that will bring you back to full strength and power, something that will mean you can never die. Mr. Potter, do you know what is hidden in the school at this very moment? The Sorcerer's Stone. Of course, the Elixir of Life. But I don't understand who... Can you think of nobody who has waited many years to return to power? Who has clung to life, awaiting their chance? It was as though an iron fist had clenched suddenly around Harry's heart. Over the rustling of the trees, he seemed to hear once more what Hagrid had told him on the night they had met. Some say he died. Codswallop, in my opinion. Dunno if he had enough human left in him to die. Do you mean, Harry croaked, that was
This moment really solidifies the severity of the situation with the Sorcerer's Stone. Up to this point, Harry has been curious and wondered what Snape was up to, thinking he was the one behind it all. Now, Harry realizes that the situation is much worse. If Voldemort drinks the Elixir of Life, he can return to power. It's so much more than curiosity and catching Snape out now. It has to do with Harry's life and the fate of the Wizarding World. Harry realizes that he has to do what needs to be done and be brave. He has to save the Sorcerer's Stone first.
Yeah, that's so true. And think about it this way. Harry is 11 years old. You know, he just got used to the reality of himself being a wizard and also the fact that he's famous. And he's like, okay, I'm just going to go through life at this wizard school, try and be normal, you know, try not to act like I'm famous and the Chosen One. But here Ferenc is confirming, hey, you're the Chosen One. This guy's after the stone. You better stop him. And Harry's like, oh, great. You know, I have to step up to the plate. Whereas all I wanted to do was hang out with my friends. I think Polly's delivering us a parcel from Vault 713. Oh, wait, it's just the fun facts.
Hey, it's Polly, our owl. She's flying in with the fun facts. Thank you so much, Polly. Let's get into these Sorcerer's Stone fun facts. So let's start off by talking about the Sorcerer's or Philosopher's Stone and alchemy. The ancient study of alchemy is concerned with making the Philosopher's Stone, a legendary substance with astonishing powers. It will transform any metal into pure gold, and it also produces the Elixir of Life, which will make the drinker immortal. The stone has been the object of desire for alchemists throughout history, and it has been featured in scientific texts and works of art for centuries. It is unknown what the stone is actually supposed to look like, but there is a richly illustrated artifact which explains how to best use the stone. This is the Ripley Scroll. The Ripley Scroll is a 6-meter long alchemical treatise with illustrations, and it includes a text called Verses Upon the Elixir. Just for perspective, when this ancient scroll is hung up, it's as tall as an adult giraffe. There are only 22 known copies in the world, one of which is at the British Library and another at Yale University's Beinecke Library. These two copies share iconography, but the alchemical process is portrayed in a different order. It's believed that if the Ripley Scroll is followed, one can learn how to turn base metal into gold and live forever. Naturally, people have been trying this for centuries without any success. But if you happen to get your hands on a copy of the Ripley Scroll, here are the instructions. Stage 1. At the top of the scroll is a red-robed, white-bearded figure who is the legendary Egyptian sage Hermes Trismegistus. He's holding a huge alchemical vessel with 8 scenes inside it, most of which are wise men gazing at more alchemical vessels containing human figures, some of which appear to represent Adam and Eve. There's a big picture in the center that shows Hermes presenting a secret book to George Ripley, who the scroll is named after. Stage 2. There's an illustration of a large tree emerging from a pool of water, with snakes twisting around it. Adam and Eve are represented in the pool. The image is extremely symbolic and informative. The tree represents knowledge, the snakes represent the chemical sulfur, and Eve represents the chemical mercury. At this stage, a white stone is created. Stage 3. Under the white stone, a dragon is eating a toad. At the time when the scroll was created, it was believed that toads were created spontaneously, rather than developing into tadpoles from eggs. Here, the dragon and toad, together spontaneously, create a black stone. Stage 4. The image shows a red line and a green line on either side of a furious fire. This means that red sulfur and the ore from which the essence of mercury is extracted are added to the black stone over heat to create the red stone. Stage 5. There is an image of the golden bird, Hermes, like an eagle but with the face of a man wearing a crown. The bird represents regeneration and the powerful vapors created while making the stone. Stage 6. The Philosopher's Stone is represented as the three-colored stone, white, black, and red. It is depicted in a bright burning sun, which represents gold, and circled by a crescent moon, which represents silver. The stones are held up by a dragon. The final picture shows a man holding a giant quill, which is believed to be Ripley. There's an interesting connection between the colors of the stone and characters in the Harry Potter series. Red is Rubius Hagrid, whose first name means red in Latin. White is Albus Dumbledore, whose first name means white in Latin. Obviously, black is Sirius Black. So it's super interesting how three father figures to Harry are bound together in the colors of the Philosopher's Stone. Now let's talk about Nicholas Flamel. In the Wizarding World, Nicholas Flamel created the only Sorcerer's Stone to exist, and he was created after the real Nicholas Flamel, who lived in Paris in the late 14th century and early 15th century. He has a tombstone with his name on it in the Church of Jacques de la Boucherie in Paris. It was believed that he designed the tombstone himself, and it was discovered sometime in the 19th century in a Parisian grocer's shop where it was being used as a cutting board. This is when legends started to spring up. People claimed that his grave was dug up, but there wasn't a body inside. The most popular legend, though, is that Flamel was a book dealer who came across a mysterious and magical book. The story goes that after many years of travel and study, he unlocked the book's powerful secrets. According to legend, a stranger approached Flamel with a rare manuscript, which he recognized. Not long before this encounter, an angel visited him in a dream holding a book. The angel told him, "One day you will see in it that which no other man will be able to see." The book was written by Abraham the Jew, which was in Greek and other languages, including Hebrew. The symbols in the book were instructions on alchemy. Flamel traveled to Spain to find a Jewish scholar, Maestro Canchase. Canchase translated the pages that Flamel had brought with him and agreed to translate the rest back in Paris, but he became ill on the journey and died before reaching Paris. Fortunately, Flamel had enough knowledge to finish the translation and create the stone. One of the most interesting symbols in the book depicts a serpent and crowned dragon eating each other's tails, a common alchemical symbol called an Ouroboros, which symbolizes the cycle of birth and death, and the unification of prima materia, primary matter, with spiritus universalis, universal spirit. This unification is essential to create the stone. Alright guys, I don't know how many different languages I spoke in the last couple minutes, so let's wrap up by talking about some Greek mythology, my favorite, with Fluffy and Cerberus. Fluffy is the three-headed dog that guards the trap door in Hogwarts that leads to the Sorcerer's Stone. In many ways, Fluffy is a representation of Cerberus, the three-headed dog that guarded the gates to the underworld in Greek mythology. Hercules had to capture Cerberus and take him to King Eurystheus as one of his 12 labors, and he gained immortality through completing the labors. This draws a connection with Harry and his struggle to get to the Sorcerer's Stone, because Hercules succeeded less through physical effort than courage and strength of the mind, just like Harry. And now, with Harry's courage and strength in mind, let's go through the trapdoor and get to the Sorcerer's Stone with our honorary half-blood prince, Joe.
Now, it's time to dive into the book topic of the week, for tales of magic and mischief.
So step aside, Harry, Ron, and Hermione, the real golden trio is coming through. It's the me, Jess, and Joe. So let's talk about the golden trio's journey through the trapdoor. They make it to the third floor corridor, and they realize that the door is already open. When they see the door open, this is when the real reality of the situation sets in. Harry even tells his friends that they can go back and take the invisibility cloak and he wouldn't blame them. But Ron and Hermione tell him not to be stupid and that they're coming with him. How would you guys feel in this situation? You're going to save the Sorcerer's Stone and you don't know what obstacles are lying ahead.
So for me, there's a mix. I'd be one, excited, because I love doing stuff like this. The second thing, though, if I'm putting myself in the trio's position, specifically Harry's, because we see the series through Harry's perspective anyway. Harry knows zero magic. So, like, that would scare me. Going through all these different tests and rooms, so to speak. I mean, he doesn't know that that's coming. But where magic is going to be tested and he knows nothing, that would kind of scare me a little bit.
Yeah, I would feel the exact same way. My secondary house is Gryffindor, so I'm naturally brave, but I'd also be pretty scared, especially because I'm visually impaired and it's dark down there and I wouldn't be able to see anything. That would really scare me.
The unknown would definitely scare me too, but we know we're talking about three Gryffindors here, so it's not surprising to me that they're going through with this whole plan. So they see that a harp is resting on Fluffy's feet, meaning that somebody, who they think is Snape, has already made it past the three-headed dog. Harry puts the flute that Hagrid had given him for Christmas to his lips and begins to play. Fluffy goes to sleep. Harry continues to play and Ron opens the trap door. He announces that he can't see what's lying below and that they'd have to jump. Harry, being the typical noble hero that he is, wants to go first. He gives the flute to Hermione and then he drops down through the trap door. When he lands, it feels like some sort of plant. Wonder what that could be. But he's so far beneath the school that the trap door looks like the size of a postage stamp. He announces to the others that it's a soft landing and that it's all clear and they can jump too, which they do soon after. Not knowing yet what this plant is, how would you feel? Would you feel relief like Harry? Or would you be a little anxious because this is a magic school and Merlin only knows what this plant is?
First off, before you even jump down this trap door, I would love the visual of Harry playing this flute. I think that would be he doesn't seem like a musical person at all. So if this was in the movie, I would absolutely love it.
Yeah, it's like you don't see them, you know, taking music lessons. And how does Hermione know how to play the flute? I mean, she's smart, but how does she know how to play? That's a really hard instrument to play. When I joined band in fifth grade, I was like, I want to play the flute. But I couldn't blow into it correctly, so I quit, and then I did the violin instead. But, like, at the same time, it's like, how do you know how to play the flute? And also, it almost feels like you're skydiving. If you're that far below the school, and you don't know if you're gonna splat or not, that's pretty scary, too. And it's like, I'd feel relieved that I didn't die, but at the same time, I'd be like, but what is this underneath me? Is this dangerous?
Yeah, I wanna agree with you on that, too. Jumping down into an abyss, just a black hole, that would not be something that I would want to do. And the fact that that trapdoor looked like a postage stamp from looking upwards, you know that was a very long fall. And I would not feel comfortable. I just screaming, and then like losing my breath, catching it back, and I'm still falling and have to do like another, I'd be relieved that I'd be alive, absolutely. I probably wouldn't even care that I'm getting trapped by these plants.
Yeah, I agree with everything both of you are saying. It's definitely a mixed feeling like I'm alive, but yet I just skydived through this trap door down into God knows what. So Ron's like, lucky this plant thing's here, really. And Hermione goes into full panic mode. She stumbles toward a damp wall because the plant has wrapped around her ankles. For Harry and Ron, their legs have been bound up by these long creepers without their noticing. Hermione breaks free, but the boys aren't as lucky. The more they fight against the plant, the tighter and faster it winds around them. I would be completely terrified at this point. How about you guys?
Yes and no. I'd be terrified if I wasn't sure what it was, but I have this knack of not panicking in the midst of danger, so I feel like I would definitely be able to be calm. So if we were in the movie version of this scene, I would go right through because I kind of don't fight those types of things like that. But yeah, not knowing what the actual plant is, that it's actually trying to kill me, that would be probably my issue. I'd stay calm until it gets around my neck, and then I'm like, oh, maybe I should fight now.
Yeah, I agree with you. But for me, like, it takes a couple seconds for stuff to set in, especially because I just fell down however many feet. So I'd be like, oh, I'm laying, this is comfortable, I'm just gonna roll over, and then be like, oh no. You know, it'd take a couple minutes for it to set in. Sorry, it would take a couple seconds for it to set in, and then I would panic. definitely panic. I do not like being strangled. That is not the way I want to go.
Exactly. And I feel like me, I hate when I'm like caught or like something's confining me in any way. So I would hate this whole situation. But Hermione's feeling confident because she announces for the boys to stay still, and she knows what this is. It's Devil's Snare. Harry and Ron are not impressed because it's currently trying to kill them, and Hermione's trying to figure out how to kill it. She's trying to remember. Devil's Snare! Devil's Snare! What did Professor Sprout say? It likes the dark and the damp. So light a fire, Harry choked. Yes, of course, but there's no wood, Hermione cried, wringing her hands. Have you gone mad? Ron bellowed. Are you a witch or not? Hermione's brain starts working again. She whips out her wand, mutters something, and shoots a jet of bluebell flames at the Devil's Snare. It cringes away from the warmth and the light, and Harry and Ron break free. Lucky you pay attention in herbology, Hermione, said Harry as he joined her by the wall, wiping sweat off his face. Yeah, said Ron, and lucky Harry doesn't lose his head in a crisis. There's no wood, honestly. So let's talk about this here. Obviously, we know this is Professor Sprout's obstacle. So what do you guys think of the plan in general and about the method of defending yourself against it?
I think it's like one of those cute but deadly creatures. You know, because you see a creature that's like so strong in one element, you know, like the dark, and then it kind of cringes away in the light. It's like a scared little plant. You know what I mean? It's like, it's deadly, but it's also a scaredy cat. Because I just picture it like a creature just like cringing away from the light. I find this funny that this was taught in a first year herbology class. And that Hermione, being what, 11 years old, knows how to get past this. Whereas like grown wizards might not know how to do this.
I agree. And I also think it's really interesting because we see in the book a big kind of theme of good versus evil and dark and light. You know, we see that with the Dementors being these dark, like menacing creatures, and they're defeated by a Patronus, which is light, essentially. And we see that with the Devil's Snare, how it likes the dark and damp, but to defeat it, you have to create light and warmth. So I think that's really interesting as well.
The one thing I like about this part, this was the start of the story making it a point to the readers to let them know that Harry doesn't lose his head in a crisis, whereas Hermione does. Even though as smart as she is, like, she doesn't always know what to do in the midst of the crisis. And Ron points this out here when he says, are you a witch or not? I absolutely love this part. For me, I'm a Ron apologist. I wish these parts were in the movies, because in the movies, they make it as if Hermione's like the champion of champions. She knows everything. She has the answers to everything. And they really give Ron a raw deal throughout the movies, because there's a couple of times where Ron has the answer, but they just give that part to Hermione.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And I also really want to mention here, too, that your point about Hermione losing her head in a crisis, essentially, and not being on top of things where Harry is, we see that throughout the series. And I think it's really important to highlight their strengths. And as a trio, they all have strengths. And I think that's why they're so strong and they get through all these things, because each of them brings something to the table.
Exactly. Ron is loyal, Harry's brave, and Hermione's smart.
Exactly.
This way, said Harry, pointing down a stone passageway, which was the only way forward. With the water dripping down the walls and the passageway sloping downward, Harry's reminded of Gringotts and the dragons that guard the vaults. What if they met a dragon? Can you blame him? Would you be scared?
If there was a dragon, I'd be terrified. Like, trolls are one thing. Even though you were lucky, you beat the troll. But dragon? That might be a little tougher.
Until Deathly Hallows, when they do face a dragon.
Yeah, they have a little bit more experience when they do face that dragon.
Right, and I love how that comes full circle. Like, in book one, he's afraid of meeting a dragon, and then in Deathly Hallows, it's like, all right, let's ride this dragon now.
Yeah, exactly. Especially if you think about him fighting the dragon in the Triwizard Tournament.
Oh, right. I forgot about that. Yeah, definitely.
I'd be afraid too. I don't want to get burned alive. So they hear something, which is the flying keys, but they don't know this yet, and eventually walk into a lit chamber with a high arching ceiling. The trio also see jewel-bright birds flying around and a door on the opposite end. This room looks super pretty and kind of out of place for a dangerous quest. We know that this is Flitwick's task. Do you think it was his choice to design the room like this? How would you feel walking in?
I definitely think it reflects Flitwick's character so much because he's this cute little charms teacher. He's an amazing wizard and he's so kind to all his students, and we see that throughout the books. So I think it makes sense that it's not really threatening. The keys aren't attacking you. They think they're birds that are going to attack, but they're not their keys. And all you have to do is get the right key. Granted, the key doesn't want to be caught, but it's nothing super dangerous. So I think that really shows through with who Flitwick is.
Yeah, we know Flitwick has a little bit of a flair for decorations and design. He was in charge of decorating for Christmas, and he put the fairy lights on, and he was all into that. So the fact that this room has that look the way it did, where everything's kind of sparkly, shiny, and as you said, it's not super dangerous, but you need skill in order to catch the specific key that you need in order to get through to the next room. Totally Flitwick.
Yeah, and he's a Ravenclaw and he's smart, so he's obviously going to make this challenging. I completely agree with what y'all said. So obviously, Harry doesn't know what these birds are, so he operates under the assumption that the birds will attack him if he tries to walk across the room. So he runs, covering his face with his arms. Obviously, nothing happens. If you were Harry, would you assume the same thing?
I don't know if I'm smart enough to have that thought. I'd just be, not in awe, but I'd be wondering, what is this room about? Like, what is happening here? And if I'm trying to get across, what do I have to do to open that door across the way?
Yeah, for me, it'd be like curiosity, you know, like, and kind of strategizing. Like, I feel like in this moment, I wouldn't be frightened in any way. I'd be thinking like, all right, let's figure this out.
I feel the same way. I would think that they would attack me because the devil's snare just strangled me. But at the same time, I'd be like, okay, we need to try something out to see what will happen. And that's just what Harry does. So the trio gets to the door and they try opening it. Hermione uses the Alohomora charm, but there's no luck. Harry's the one who finally realizes that the birds are keys and that they must use the broomsticks to fly up and catch the one that opens the door. But it's more complicated than that. There's hundreds of keys. Ron says that they're looking for a big, old-fashioned silver one, like the color of the door handle. The trio kick off into the air amongst the keys that dart and dive out of reach, making them hard to catch. With the seeker's eye, Harry notices a large silver key with one of its blue wings bent. This means that someone already used it and got past the door. Harry points out the key to the others, and Ron goes after it, crashing into the ceiling and nearly falling off his broom. Poor Ron. Harry strategizes with the others now, telling Ron to come at it from above and Hermione from below. While they surround it, Harry will try to catch it. The key dodges his friends as expected, and Harry goes after it as it speeds toward the wall. Harry pins it to the stone with one hand. Yay! The others cheer, and they all land. Harry runs to the door and turns the key in the lock. The lock clicks and the key takes off. Harry pulls the door open. This task was obviously made for Harry, as he is a fantastic seeker and good at sports strategy. If you were Harry, having successfully completed this task, how would you feel about the tasks ahead?
I think I'd feel pretty good. The fact that he's gotten through two already without barely a scratch, even though it took a little bit of effort to get through both of them. But I'd be feeling pretty good right now. And if I were the teachers that set this up, I would be feeling pretty bad right now because three first years are just going right through this thing.
I would feel pretty good about myself too, but also like the kind of person I am, I wouldn't find myself in a false sense of security. I'd still be weary of what's to come. And one thing about this whole task I want to point out that I found really interesting is that the key that Harry had to get to open the door had a blue wing. And Flitwick is a Ravenclaw, and Ravenclaw's color is blue. So I think that's really interesting.
I think it is too. And we see here in this task that Ron has some good reasoning skills because he looks at the door and he's like, oh, that's the key we need. It's silver, it's big, it's old-fashioned, that's what we need. So Ron has a good point here. And also, I'd be weary of the tasks ahead as well. I think it's interesting, too, that this whole obstacle course, if you want to call it that, calls to everybody's strengths. Hermione, Harry, and Ron, and we'll see that in the coming tasks.
Exactly, and a point about the key, do you think Ron knows so much about it because Arthur is so obsessed with Muggle things? Like, do you think he's seen a lot of keys before?
I don't know.
Yeah, that's a good question. It's possible. I'm sure Arthur has one of those really long ring of keys that have, like, hundreds of keys on it.
Also, where did Flitwick get all these keys?
I have no clue.
They're probably transfigurated cups or spoons or forks or something.
Oh, that's smart. I was just going to say he said Accio keys and they all came flying toward him.
Oh, yeah, that's going to.
Flitwick is absolutely perfect, and I love how his happy personality is in this task.
So they step into the next chamber as the light started to flood the room, which evidently revealed this giant wizard's chessboard. They were on the side of the black chess pieces and looking across at the empty faces of the white chess pieces. Now, this is my absolute favorite part of this entire book. So I'm so thankful that you gave me this specific chamber in order to dive into right here because, oh, my boy Ron shines here. Continuing on, Harry pondered how to get across this room and Ron responds, "It's obvious, isn't it? We've got to play our way across the room." Ron confirms this by walking up to the Black Knight and asking him, "I don't know if I would have had the wherewithal to go up to one of the chess pieces and just like, hey, is this what I have to do?" And just waiting for the chess piece to respond. What about you?
I'd be terrified because it's like giant, you know, and you don't know what it's going to do. Like, it could crush you just for coming up to it. I definitely wouldn't do that. I'd yell across the room and be like, hey, are we playing or not?
At the same time, though, Ron is such a good chess player that he probably feels so confident. And he's like, you know what? I'm just going to walk up to this knight and be like, yo, knight, what do? Do we play across? So I feel like this is Ron's, you know, like, comfort zone right here.
Yeah, Ron has shined in virtually every part of this task. He was the one that encouraged Hermione with the devil's snare. He had some good ideas and good deduction skills in the keys chamber. And now here he is in something that he's very familiar with, wizard's chess. He loves wizard chess. I do have another question here that I wanted to present to you both. How did the chess pieces reset? We know that somebody else has been down in this room, and we also know that Quirrell has made his way through at this point. Shouldn't the chess pieces be completely in shambles right now? Does the room automatically reset after someone goes through it? I always wondered what's going on with that.
That's a really good question that I never thought of before. But this is McGonagall's obstacle, and maybe she put some charm on the room that when you cross into the next chamber, there's some, like, reset activation spell that regenerates and fixes all the pieces and put them back on their spots.
Well, the other thing, too, is what if one of the pieces broke? McGonagall must have a Reparo charm all across their room, because if one of the pieces broke, you know, the game wouldn't work out. So there's definitely some sort of, like, fix-it spell here, too.
Exactly.
Yeah, definitely. Ron says, "Now, don't be offended or anything, but neither of you are that good at chess." I love that he's trying not to hurt Harry and Hermione's feelings here. But at the same time, they knew it to be true as well. Ron tells Harry to be the bishop, Hermione to be the castle, and he says that he'll be the knight. The chess pieces hear him, and they walk off, leaving their empty spots. And then, white moves first. Ron starts directing his team's pieces, including Harry and Hermione, as Harry was wondering, what happened if they would lose? Which is actually a good question. Not only the piece part, but if they end up losing a game, does it just reset and you get another go?
I don't think you get another go. I think one of the pieces picks you up and throws you out of the room.
Yeah, I don't know. But then you can just get the key and open the door again and go back in. So I don't know if there's like a spell on the room that recognizes when the same person comes back again. I don't know.
There has to be a spell, and then the angry pieces would just attack you, right? I would assume.
Mm-hmm.
I'm surprised that there's not some kind of alarm going off with the teachers who set up these different chambers and tasks. Or be like, you know what, someone's down here trying to get through. You may want to check out what's going on.
Oh yeah, I never thought of that.
Yeah, that's interesting. Because shouldn't someone be monitoring the room at all times? Like, shouldn't someone be standing guard outside the door and, like, making sure no one gets through? I mean, I guess they want Fluffy to do that, but at the same time, it's like, there should be, like, wizard surveillance of some kind.
Exactly. And honestly, you know, like, the wizardry world has terrible security. Just look at the ministry. How they can just walk into the ministry in Deathly Hallows. And how Sirius Black can just get into the castle and Prisoner of Azkaban at the dog. Like, they have terrible security, and I feel like the teachers are so confident in their magic that they're like, nobody's gonna get past this. Well, 3 11-year-olds just did it, or first years. So, yes, they did.
If it's one person playing this chess game, and they get knocked out by the queen or whatever, they're gonna be knocked out for, God, I don't know how long you stay knocked out for, 30 minutes, an hour or so. There has to be a teacher that's able to come down and be like, arrest this person, you know? The first real shock came when their other knight was taken by the queen. The queen smashed him to the floor and dragged him off the board. They continued playing the game until Ron had this to say. Yes, it's the only way. I've got to be taken. No, Harry and Hermione shouted. That's chess, snapped Ron. You've got to make sacrifices. I'll make my move, and she'll take me. That leaves you to checkmate the king, Harry. Oh, what Gryffindorness. What bravery. Oh, Ronald. Here I go. Now, don't hang around once you've won. Ron's face paled as he made his move. And, as expected, the queen pounced and struck Ron hard around the head with her stone arm, and he crashed to the floor. The queen then dragged him off to one side. Harry then made his move, and the White King removed his crown and laid it at Harry's feet. The chessmen bowed, clearing the way to the door, and Harry and Hermione charged through and up the next passageway. At this point, I cannot believe that they didn't go and check on him. I think that's the one part they got in the movie better than this part in the book.
Yeah, he could be dead for all they know.
I feel like they couldn't, though, because they'd have to go back across the board.
Oh, that's a good point. Walking across the board.
So the king lays his crown at Harry's feet. Why doesn't Harry just take the crown?
What would he do with it?
I don't know, but it's cool. He could use it as like a trophy.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Harry and Hermione wonder what's next as they reviewed all the tasks they've completed already and determined it was down to Quirrell's and Snape's task. They reach the next door and enter in. Now, I have a question here. There are many other teachers in the building. Why did Hermione just assume that it was only the teachers that she was familiar with that had protections around the stone?
I have no idea. Trelawney could have had a task, too.
That's a good point, but I feel like on JK's part, we don't meet all the teachers in this book. So the teachers that JK used as the ones who created obstacles were all teachers that we met at some point.
Absolutely, definitely. I was just, if there was like an arithmancy task or a stargazing task, astrology. Moving on. A ghastly smell smacks them across their face, making them pull up their robes to try to block it out. They realize there's an even larger troll than the one that they had seen on Halloween that had already been knocked out in front of them that had a bloody lump on its head. Harry was thankful he didn't have to fight that one. They quickly leave this room as the smell became too much to bear.
I bet trolls smell so bad that, like, you would throw up when you see one. I feel like that's what I would do. Even though it was passed out, I'd probably throw up on it.
Yeah. The visual I'm getting, have either of you seen Tom and Jerry?
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, like, the visual I'm getting is, like, the lump on the head is when, like, Jerry would hit Tom with something, and then that big, gross lump would, like, grow out of his head. That's, like, what I'm picturing right now.
Oh, yeah.
I can definitely see that.
So Harry pulls open the next door, and he and Hermione hardly dare to look at what comes next. But this room doesn't look very frightening. There's a table with seven, the magic number seven, bottles sitting on it in a line. To be honest, I would think this is the most frightening because it appears otherwise. With the other obstacles, it was very clear the danger and what you were facing. But with this one, there's just bottles sitting on a table. How am I supposed to know that one isn't going to explode or something if I take a step forward? How would you guys feel?
For me, it would be more curiosity, too. Obviously, we've just gone through a whole bunch of very different tasks. So seeing these seven bottles all lined up on a table, I'd be like, okay, what the heck's going on here now? Like, what craziness do I have to do now?
I would assume that if you walked close to them or you touched a bottle, it would like freeze your hand or poison your hand or like catch on fire, like you were saying to me. Like, I'd be scared to touch the bottle. I think like, oh, the bottle is the prize to get to the next task, and like some animal's just gonna come out and like prevent me from drinking it. Like the whole Sphinx in the Triwizard Tournament, like that's what I would picture.
I would feel super unsettled, like I just said. And what makes this even more unsettling is the fact that this is obviously Snape's obstacle. Harry's wondering what they have to do, and when he and Hermione cross the threshold, wouldn't you know, purple flames spring up in the doorway behind them, and black fire shoots up in the doorway leading onward. So basically, they're trapped in this room with doorways covered with fire, with seven bottles just on a table. I'm all for the purple and black color combo. They're the colors of my room, but no thank you. How would you guys feel if you were trapped in this room with fire blocking the exits?
I feel like I was in an escape room, you know, like the ones that you can go to, where you're like, oh, there's clues everywhere. Like, we have to, like, go through this room, and there's going to be some sort of timer that, like, if you don't get to it in time, the flames are going to engulf you. That's what I would assume.
I absolutely love escape rooms. Every chance I get, I will go to an escape room. It's one of the worst parts of being in the midst of this pandemic right now is that me and my friends can't go to escape rooms because we have done so many of them, and we've actually gotten really stinking good at them. But nevertheless, sidebar. From the outside looking in on this specific task, this is super cool. I appreciate this task set up by Snape because, yes, it is scary. Yes, you still don't know what the heck you're doing. And yes, you're surrounded by fire with seven potions. And now it's like, you're either going to get through or you're going to die. Like, now it's on. Now it's really on.
Honestly, though,
it's like images can be deceiving. So it's like, it looks sort of benign, the just bottles on the table, but you're like, well, it's not.
Exactly. This is personally my favorite of the tasks. So Hermione goes up to the table with the seven bottles on it and picks up a roll of paper that's lying next to it. And this is what the paper says.
Danger lies before you while safety lies behind. Two of us will help you, whichever you would find. One among us seven will let you move ahead. Another will transport the drinker back instead. Two among our number hold only meadow wine. Three of us are killers, waiting hidden in line. Choose, unless you wish to stay here forevermore. To help you in your choice, we give you these clues for. First, however slyly the poison tries to hide, you will always find some on meadow wine's left side. Second, different are those who stand at either end, but if you would move onward, neither is your friend. Third, as you see clearly, all are different size. Neither dwarf nor giant holds death in their insides. Fourth, the second left and the second on the right are twins. Once you taste them, though different at first sight.
Alright, I have questions. First of all, how freaking creepy is it that this riddle is written from the point of view of the bottles? Also, where did Snape learn how to write a poetic riddle that literally rhymes? I want to know.
Oh, you know Snape is secretly into poetry. Can't you just see him pining over Lily as the Marauders are getting them their way? He's sitting in a corner, and his love for her isn't being reciprocated, and he's just pining away in the corner, looking for different words that rhyme with each other. I totally see this.
That's so funny.
That's true. I mean, he'll have to think of words that rhyme with Lily, so there you go. I didn't even think of that. That's hilarious. Now, I honestly am, like, terrified that it's in the point of view of the bottles. Because you're personifying the bottles, and also the bottles do something to you. So that's creepy, because it's like you're either going to get drunk on the ones that are wine, you're going to turn a different color based on the colorful ones, or you're going to die or go back to the room ahead or the room behind.
Hermione is feeling super confident. She sighs and smiles and says, "This isn't magic. This is logic. It's a puzzle. Even the greatest wizards, some of them don't have an ounce of logic, and they'd be stuck in this room forever." Hermione explains that everything they need is on the paper. There are 7 bottles. There are 3 that are poison, 2 are wine, 1 will get the drinker through the black fire toward the stone, and another bottle will get them back through the purple fire. I am all for Hermione's confidence here, and I personally like riddles when my life doesn't depend on it. But I feel like I figure out the riddle eventually because I love mysteries.
But again, how does this room reset itself? Like, what if someone came in and messed up the line of potions? And then you're screwed.
Yeah, and then looking at the other rooms, like, you know the troll was still knocked out, so that room didn't reset itself. So you're almost thinking, like, okay, which ones are affected by other people going into it? Which ones are not? Does it depend on the professor that set up the room? And you have to weigh all this stuff.
Also, we know this room doesn't necessarily reset itself because, as I'm going to talk about in a second, when Harry goes to drink the bottle that will move him onward, there's only enough left for one person. So the potion didn't refill after what they think is Snape drank it.
True. So if another person comes through, you're doubly screwed. Unless you know you're Dumbledore. So.
Exactly. Yeah. So Hermione rereads the riddle and walks up and down the line of bottles until she finally comes to a conclusion and claps her hands. The smallest bottle will get them through the black fire toward the stone, and a rounded bottle near the right end of the line will get them back through the purple. As I said before, there's only enough for one person to drink the smallest bottle to get to the stone. So Harry tells Hermione to drink the rounded bottle to go back through the purple fire. He tells her to get Ron, get brooms from the room with the charmed keys, to go up through the trap door and send Hedwig to Dumbledore for help. Hermione throws her arms around Harry, and this is one of my favorite exchanges between the two. "Harry, you're a great wizard, you know." "I'm not as good as you," said Harry, very embarrassed, as she let go of him. "Me," said Hermione. "Books and cleverness. There are more important things. Friendship and bravery and, oh, Harry, be careful." I love this because I feel like this really solidifies their special friendship. So Hermione drinks the bottle that will get her back through the purple fire, and she declares that it's like ice. Before walking through the flames, she tells Harry to take care and good luck. When Harry drains what is left of the smallest bottle, he too feels like ice is flooding his body. And then he moves onward into the last chamber.
I, too, love that interaction between Hermione and Harry. The only thing that got me was the fact that Hermione is telling Harry that he's a great wizard. Yet, at this point, Harry has done literally no magic outside of flying. And then what she lists, like friendship and bravery, I totally agree with this statement here. And I love that she puts those things on a higher esteem than the other stuff. But friendship and bravery have nothing to do with magic. So the fact that she lists those off as him being a great wizard, I was just like, Harry is not a great... Yes, he will be a great wizard, but Harry has done, like, no wizardry yet. Nothing.
Yeah, that's true. If you think about it, Hermione was the star of the first book until this whole chapter, basically.
Right. And honestly, would you guys trust her about walking through fire? Like, would you trust her that this potion is going to get me safely through fire?
If I want to get out of there, I have no other option, so I trust her.
I think I would because she has proven herself over the course of the year to be correct more often than not.
Exactly. And one more point I'd like to make here, too, is going back to the opposites we were talking about, too, with the devil's snare. We see it here, too, because we have the ice, which is the sensation you get when you drink the bottle, but you're walking through fire, and fire and ice are those opposites.
In the last chamber, we meet Quirrell, not Snape, and we see that the last task involves the Mirror of Erised. Yay! One of my favorite objects. Quirrell is unsuccessful with the mirror and makes Harry look into it. Harry sees his pale and scared-looking reflection when he looks into the mirror. But a moment later, the reflection smiled at him. It put its hand into its pocket and pulled out a blood-red stone. It winked and put the stone back in its pocket, and as it did so, Harry felt something heavy drop into his real pocket. Somehow, incredibly, he'd gotten the stone. What just happened? Like, how the heck is this possible?
# magic.
Exactly. Like, Jess and I talked about this in our Mirror of Erised episode. Like, where was the stone kept before it just appeared in Harry's pocket? Do you have any ideas, Joe?
Well, we know Dumbledore set this up. Dumbledore added this magic to the mirror. So, it was something in his brain. I'm thinking it became part of the mirror at some point, and then was able to travel through. Again, I can't explain it, so on our show, Tales from Godric's Hollow, whenever we have no explanation for what happens, # magic.
Quirrell asks Harry what he saw, and Harry lies, saying he saw himself shaking hands with Dumbledore because he's won the House Cup for Gryffindor. Quirrell curses, telling Harry to get out of the way. Just as Harry starts to make a break for it, Voldemort speaks, saying that Harry is lying. Quirrell tells Harry to come back and tell the truth about what he saw. Voldemort demands to speak to Harry, so Quirrell undoes his turban and turns around. Where there should have been a back to Quirrell's head, there was a face, the most terrible face Harry had ever seen. It was chalk white with glaring red eyes and slits for nostrils, like a snake. As a kid, I couldn't watch this part of the movie. Like, I nearly peed myself. How would you guys react if you were Harry?
My first thought would be to hightail it the hell out of there, but the black fire is still there, so, like, I wouldn't be able to walk back through.
Yeah, because with my luck, the frickin' potion had worn off, and I would be stuck in those flames.
Exactly.
For me, it wouldn't necessarily surprise me, because over the past, like, 9 or 10 months, this whole new world has been opened up to me. And I've been experiencing so many different new things that I never even imagined would be possible. So the fact that there's now a face staring at me from the back of someone's head, I'd be like, oh, great, another new thing.
That creeped me out, though.
But that shouldn't be possible. Well, # magic.
Exactly. Now you're learning.
So Voldemort talks to Harry, the creep, and says that he only has a form when he's in someone else's body. The unicorn blood Quirrell drank strengthened him, and once he has the elixir of life, he can create his own body. Then he asks for the stone. How does he know Harry has it?
The Horcrux. It's the Horcrux.
I completely agree with you.
I think Voldemort was bluffing here. I think he assumed that Harry could get the stone and just kind of made a lucky guess just to see if Harry would squirm, and Harry ended up squirming and gave it away, really.
That's a good point. I didn't think of that.
True, it's like a nervous tic. Like when you lie, you smile, or when you're nervous, you like blink or fidget, and that's exactly what he did. So Harry and Voldemort have a back and forth here, and Harry refuses to give up the stone. He goes toward the flame door. What is he thinking? But he's seized by the wrist by Quirrell. Harry feels pain in his scar and in his head, and Quirrell lets go. The pain subsides a little, and Harry notices that Quirrell's fingers are blistering. At Voldemort's urging, Quirrell lunges for Harry and knocks him off his feet. Quirrell lands on top of Harry and puts his hands around Harry's neck. Harry's scar hurts again, and Quirrell howls in pain. Quirrell lets go again, noticing that his hands are now burned, raw, red, and shiny. Voldemort tells Quirrell to kill Harry, and Quirrell obeys, raising his hand to perform a curse. Harry grabs his face. Quirrell rolls off Harry, and his face is blistering. Harry finally catches on that Quirrell can't touch him without suffering pain. He grabs Quirrell's arm.
Quirrell screamed and tried to throw Harry off. The pain in Harry's head was building. He couldn't see. He could only hear Quirrell's terrible shrieks and Voldemort's yells of, "Kill him! Kill him!" and other voices, maybe in Harry's own head, crying, "Harry! Harry!" He felt Quirrell's arm wrenched from his grasp, knew all was lost, and fell into blackness. Down, down, down. So, we know that Lily's protection made it so that Quirrell couldn't touch Harry. I find it interesting, though, that Harry also experiences pain in his scar. Is this because he's a Horcrux, and Lily's protection is destroying the piece of Voldemort inside him?
I think it's Voldemort's presence so close, and the fact that he's, like, basically, his soul is kind of living in Quirrell, and he's so close to Harry, because we know in Order of the Phoenix, like, every time Voldemort experiences, like, a strong emotion or was near Harry in some way, his scar hurt. So I think that's, like, the first taste of it here.
That would make sense, because Harry's Horcrux obviously can't be destroyed unless he dies.
Right.
Yeah, I think it has a little bit to do with the proximity, but I also think that because Voldemort is in so much pain and torment, whether it be internally, emotionally, due to him not having a body, due to him getting blasted by the killing curse so many years ago, I think Harry is experiencing a little bit of that pain that Voldemort has been living with for the past however many years. And due to, again, the proximity of them being so close, Harry is starting to feel it. The only place where a little piece of Voldy is as well, and that is his scar.
Yeah, it's kind of funny because it's like burning love. Like, her burning love made him burn. So I think that's hilarious. Also, it would have been funnier if Harry just burst into flames due to Lily's protection and, like, was like, "Get back! Get back!" That would have been funnier.
Also, question about Harry here. That doesn't surprise me. Clearly, like, after first touch or even the second time, it's clear that Quirrell is getting burned every time he touches Harry. It takes Harry a hot minute to realize, oh, wait, he can't touch me, which we see a lot through the series. Like, Harry is kind of slow on the uptake and, like, realizing when things are happening, and I think that's the first instance of that here.
I agree. Also, what I've wondered is if Voldemort has some control of Quirrell's body here, because Quirrell obviously doesn't want to touch Harry. Like, he screams and he, like, is like, but I can't kill him, but I can't kill him. And Voldemort's like, you have to. So it's like, I feel like Voldemort, as he got stronger, maybe had some control over Quirrell's body and, like, did this to Harry.
No, it's like possession almost.
Almost as if Quirrell couldn't help himself but follow what Voldemort demanded.
Right. Yeah, that's really interesting.
Harry wakes up in a bit of a daze, thinking that he's looking at a golden snitch when he tries to grab it, but his arm's too heavy. He blinks and then realizes it wasn't a snitch, but glasses, and then realizing the whole time it was Dumbledore. Now, I kind of feel like there is something to this, because at the end of the series, when Dumbledore dies, he leaves the snitch to Harry. There's always this connection between the snitch and Harry, and I feel like this was purposely done to kind of put the snitch in Harry waking up and seeing that as the first thing. I don't know why, but I just feel like JK totally did that on purpose just to keep that in our heads.
She definitely did. And I, like, my favorite book is Deathly Hallows. I read it so many times, and the parallel between this and the ending is so interesting, because the whole story of the Tale of Three Brothers and all that, like, in Harry's story, like, Dumbledore's kind of the metaphor for death, and Harry almost died, and now here's the snitch that Harry's seen. And then at the end, when Harry opens the snitch and then he dies, he sees Dumbledore, but at the same time, the Resurrection Stone was in that, so it's almost like, in the first book, it was like a foreshadowing to, like, Harry's resurrection in a way. It's really interesting. I love this whole, like, parallel here.
Yeah.
Yeah, this definitely fascinates me. Like, I love how she's brilliantly planting all these things in the first couple books, and you don't realize it until you do a reread.
Yeah, she's good at that. Dumbledore greets Harry, but Harry says, "The stone! It was Quirrell! He's got it! Yada, yada, yada." Dumbledore calms him down and says that Harry's a little bit behind on the times, and that Quirrell does not have the stone. Harry frantically asks who does, and Dumbledore tries to settle him down before Poppy comes in to throw down and to throw everyone out. I love Madame Pomfrey's power that Dumbledore gives her, that she can even kick the headmaster out of the hospital wing. That is fantastic. Harry looks around and realizes he is at the hospital wing, surrounded by an extreme amount of candy and what would have been a toilet seat had Madame Pomfrey not removed it. Hashtag hygiene.
The twins!
Dumbledore explains that these gifts are tokens from his admirers. What happened down in the dungeons between you and Professor Quirrell is a complete secret. So, naturally, the whole school knows. Such a great line.
I love it.
There's no secrets in this series at all. Except for the Horcruxes, and that's it.
And the Chamber of Secrets in the next book. Dun dun dun.
That's true.
Dumbledore tells Harry he's been in the hospital for 3 days, and that Ron and Hermione will be excited to hear that he's finally woken up. Harry responds, "But sir, the stone!" And Dumbledore's like, "I see you are not to be distracted." Dumbledore explains that he had arrived just in time to stop Quirrell from taking the stone and had to pull him off of Harry. When he had gotten to the Ministry, he realized that the place he should have been at all along was Hogwarts. Dumbledore said that he feared he was too late, not to save the stone necessarily, but to save Harry's life. Question here. There are so many quicker ways to get to the Ministry and back from Hogwarts. Why did he choose the slowest way ever?
Yeah, like, the guy can create port keys for himself. Like, why didn't he take a port key?
Maybe he just wanted to enjoy the fresh air.
That's a really dumb excuse.
But that is such a Dumbledore thing, especially knowing Harry's life is hanging in the balance. Here's Dumbledore. For all we know, he's flying on one of those magic carpets that had to get confiscated. Because I could totally see that being a thing for him.
Yeah. He's, like, driving. He's like, oh, look at the birds.
Like, Dumbledore, save Harry already. Could have used a flu network, been back in 10 seconds. Jeez.
I mean, he has a flair for the dramatic, so I guess he wanted to get there just in time. He was, like, sitting there going, how much longer can I wait? How much longer is this going to take? Like, maybe if I wait one more second, I'll still be able to save him.
Had I not stopped for lemon drops on the way, maybe Harry's life could have been saved. Dumbledore discloses that the stone has been destroyed. Harry then asks, well, what about Nicholas Flamel? Oh, you know about Nicholas, said Dumbledore, sounding quite delighted. You did do the thing properly, didn't you? I love that line so much. I feel like this, it almost was like this whole thing was a test for Harry to see how much he was able to discover about this whole situation and to see if Harry was just so erratic in his responses to his thoughts about Snape and everything that he would just go down without even finding out what the stone was or was about or who made it or whatever. Or if he were to do that. And it seems like, obviously, Dumbledore was quite delighted, so he enjoyed that response from Harry. Dumbledore said he had a little chat with Nicholas and determined it was best that the stone be destroyed. Harry said, doesn't that mean they will die? And Dumbledore's like, yup. They have enough elixir to set their affairs in order, but then they will pass on. Dumbledore goes on to say that to someone as young as Harry, it must seem incredible. But to Nicholas and his wife, Perronel, it's like going to bed after a very, very long day. And I love this quote, too. After all, to the well-organized mind, death is but the next great adventure. You know, the stone was really not such a wonderful thing. As much money and life as you could want. The two things most human beings would choose above all. The trouble is, humans do have a knack of choosing precisely those things which are worst for them. So basically, Dumbledore is quoting Biggie Smalls here, Notorious B.I.G., mo money, mo problems.
I didn't see that coming.
And it's so true. It is so true. I feel like Dumbledore on the down low, he's listening to some rap and hip hop. Now, my question here, though, to the second part of that quote, which I found really interesting, It kind of sounds like Dumbledore is throwing a little bit of shade at Nicholas Flamel here for creating the stone and using it for as long as he did. Because it seemed like he disagreed with the use of the stone in general. How do you feel about that?
I think he did. Because he said that, you know, those are the two things that are worst for you. I mean, there has to be an end in sight. Life can't just not end. Because if it doesn't end, then you don't have, like, a time bomb ticking for when you have to, you know, leave this world. You don't try to make your mark on the world because you know you're going to live forever. So I feel like life has to end. And it's like, oh, you have money, but love is more important than money, in my opinion. I'd rather be poor and in love than have money and have nobody.
I see a parallel between the stone and the Deathly Hallows in a way. We know when Dumbledore was younger, he and Grindelwald wanted to go on the quest to find the Hallows, and he gave that up. Dumbledore gave that up. And I feel like Dumbledore realized after the whole thing with Ariana that being the master of death and being invincible isn't the most important thing. And I feel like after that whole experience, that kind of shapes his perspective on the stone.
Exactly, because would you rather sacrifice a family member for what you want or not? I mean, family is also really important, and he lost his family because of his ambitions.
Yeah, no, I agree with all of that. Flamel, though, here, you said you'd rather have love than money. Flamel had both, and I think he just wanted to enjoy all of it while he had it for as long as he could. I wonder if Flamel, though, had thought that there would eventually have to come a time where this stone needed to be destroyed, because if somebody knew that you could live forever, that he would have an X on his back, so to speak, and somebody would be coming after him.
Just like the Elder Wand.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, if it's valuable, people are going to want it. But what I would assume they would have done is as soon as they knew that Voldemort came into power, right, because they were alive when Voldemort came into power, they would have just destroyed it because they would have known that he would have come for it eventually.
Yeah, and I also wonder if this will play into their relationship in the upcoming Fantastic Beasts movies that's going to come out. Like, are we going to see this little back and forth between Dumbledore and Flamel? We know how close they are, but will the stone come up and the fact that maybe you need to, you know, destroy the stone?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, exactly.
So to wrap up this awesome discussion about the Sorcerer's Stone, we're going to ask each other some questions about the obstacles.
All right, guys, which obstacle do you find most interesting?
For me, I absolutely love the potions task. And I'll tell you why. It's because my first time going through the series again, it was the movies. So when I finally decided I was going to actually sit down and read the books and I got to this part, my mind was completely blown. I'm like, there were more chambers and more tasks in this that we didn't see in the movies? Oh, man, I was so upset about that. And the fact that I absolutely love escape rooms, this totally seemed like an escape room thing for me as well. And I'm just like, I'm all for it right now.
Even though the potions task is my favorite one, I feel like the most interesting one to me is a toss-up between the flying keys or the charmed key room and McGonagall's chess game, because I love Flitwick and I feel like he was super crafty with the whole charmed keys, and also McGonagall being so badass and creating this literally like human-sized real-life chess game is super interesting to me. So it's a tie between those two.
I agree with Joe. I think the most interesting obstacle is the potions, especially because I think the riddle is really clever.
All right, I got a question for you. Which obstacle would you feel most confident in facing?
I feel like I'd be most confident getting past Fluffy because I am a musician. So I could take my guitar, I could sing, I could take my ukulele. If I could, I bring a piano along. So I feel like being musical, I wouldn't be scared at all.
I just pictured to me like having a whole concert going on and then who's ever down there comes up and goes, hey, what are you doing? I'm trying to find the stone.
Can you keep it down? Jeez.
So for me, I'm gonna have to say the mirror, because I feel like I'd have a great chance of pulling out the stone. Like, I just want the stone to get it away from Voldemort, and that's why Harry wants it. So I feel like me and the mirror have, like, a understanding that I'd be able to pull it out. But, of course, my butt would need help through all the other obstacles.
Well, for me, this one's easy. It would be the troll task, because it was already knocked out. Just walk right through holding your nose. Done.
But what if it wasn't knocked out, then? What if Kroll didn't go first?
So if the troll's not knocked out, a little fun fact about me. I used to travel around as a professional wrestler, so I know how to handle bigger guys. Now, granted, this thing is much bigger than probably anybody I had stepped in the ring with, but I'd feel confident in my skills. I could take him down.
Go you.
Like, you could just transfigure your wand into a bat and just start hitting him with it.
Yeah.
So, last question for you guys. Which obstacle would you feel most terrified facing?
For me, it would be the chessboard, because I don't know how to play chess. And also, the way those pieces are just sitting there judging you and wanting to kill you, yeah, no thanks.
I'm decent at chess. I don't know if I could beat the computer, but I know how to work a chessboard. I wouldn't necessarily be terrified of that, though. So for me, it's probably going to be the charmed keys task, because another little known fact about me, I'm a little afraid of heights. So having to climb up on this small broom and being a little bit bigger of a guy and having to go however many feet up in the air to try to catch this thing while trying to balance myself on a broom, that would scare the heck out of me. So I would not want to do that. I would try to avoid that as much as I possibly can.
I get that. For me, it'd be the freaking devil snare that tried to suffocate me. Don't like the plan. So listeners, we hope you enjoyed our episode about the Sorcerer's Stone. If you have any comments or would like to answer the questions we asked each other at the end, please let us know on social or leave us a voicemail. Thank you so much, Joe, for being our honorary Half-Blood Prince. How did you like being on?
Oh, it was so much fun. I love talking about Harry Potter. So whenever I can get on and talk to anybody, I am all for it. So thank you guys so much for having me on. I really had a lot of fun.
Yeah, thank you. You brought up some really cool points that I didn't even think about. So this has been awesome.
Yeah, it really has. Would you like to share with our listeners where they could find you?
Sure. You can find me personally on Instagram or the Twitter at Custom Vinyl Lush. Or if you want to check out our show, you could do so at Tales from Godric's Hollow. Or you could find us on Twitter at Tales from GH.
Awesome. Thank you so much again.
Yeah, thank you.
No problem, anytime.
All right, listeners, we have a little update for you guys. From now on, our episodes are going to be released every 3 weeks instead of every other week. So that being said, our next episode comes out on Friday, March 12th. So stay tuned for that. Thank you guys again for listening. Bye.
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 Thank you for listening to this chapter of the Half-Blood Princesses, a Harry Potter podcast.
Hedwig's theme and Leaving Hogwarts in this episode were originally composed by John Williams and arranged by me. Until next time, mark this page with a magical bookmark.